Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net.
On today's episode.
In your view, which is actually more dangerous for LGBTQ plus communities? Is it being counted badly or just being left out of the census?
Increasingly, I think we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't in lots of these conversations. Being counted badly invites a lot of risks and dangers. Or is always going to be weaponized in good and bad ways.
This is Outcast World.
This is Outcast World. Welcome along. It's Graham Smith here. Topher Taylor joins me, and on the show today, we are chatting again to the author, an academic at the University of Edinburgh, where he's officially involved in the business school, but he is an expert and academic on gender and sexuality. Written two books, The Rainbow Trap, which we touched on in our last episode, about how you can kind of, as a queer person, just get caught up in having to do all the work for the company that you work for that wants to seem like they're really... really on the ball when it comes to where things are up to politically, and then before you know it, the political tides have changed and you're fucked. I'm paraphrasing. We discussed that on the last episode, and then we're getting on this one to his book, Queer Data, which is just really interesting as to how, like, here's an example, the census. How do we collect information about trans people in particular, about different aspects of being LGBTQ+, who decides which categorizations go into the census and which we're not collecting information on? And when we're not collecting information on people, do they even exist? It's a really kind of sleight of hand kind of tactic that is used across government and corporations to kind of make queer people visible or invisible, dependent on the way the political weather is blowing. Topher Taylor joins me. We were talking about, we've been in much conversation about this recently because it's something that we feel has happened to both of us. But in our last episode, lots of conversations around how you might have a queer boss that sees... So, a straight boss that has a queer member of staff, but because they're not behaving in ways that they can, like, I've seen a queer person on television, they're like Alan Carr, so why do you not fit into that? And how just that lack of understanding can cause all kinds of issues. Say you work somewhere and a manager's a bit of a dick, and he's straight, and doesn't understand queer culture, but insists that they do. Do you say, no, you've got that wrong, or that's a bit ignorant about trans people, that kind of thing? Or do you just keep your mouth shut because you know at the end of it you'll still remain paid? And in the situation of where someone's like, I don't know, DEI kind of thing, and you've got a CEO who's got whatever, how do you...
It's complex.
It's about the end result.
With me, I've always found, like, even in the adult industry, people would expect that it's very liberal, and it's really not. Oh. There's really, really old school, very, very misogynistic, and that misogyny leans itself into homophobia and, of course, transphobia. So when I've heard things, I haven't been the person in the office screaming and preaching. I've been drip-feeding. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've literally changed people's minds. And that sounds very arrogant, but I have.
No, it makes sense.
I've seen it happen. I've seen colleagues of mine go from being like, oh, fucking, you know, they didn't say woke back in the day. It was always like social justice warrior.
Mm-hmm. Or PC.
Yeah, the PC crowd.
PC brigade.
Back in that day, I was always called SJW, you know, social justice warrior.
Right.
But I was just drip feeding information. I wouldn't like barking people. And the thing is, I have the privilege to do that. Because of the situations I got myself into, like being a white, blonde, blue-eyed gay, I could communicate with people and, you know, drip-feed information using that privilege. So it's like, which one is it? Do I not use the privilege? Do I use it for good? Do I use it for my own good? Or, mm-hmm. you know, and I drip-fed for years. And as soon as I got into a position of power in the adult industry, I was like, right, the decisions are mine now. I was hiring models of all different persuasions.
Yeah.
I was making sure everyone was included to the best of my ability. I was making sure size ranges of underwear, even, for example, were expanded, that we had customers who were saying for years, we don't fit. So that's what it took for me personally, is that it took me a long time of drip feeding. You know, I was dealing for years with a managing director who was incredibly ignorant. He had his own issues of his sexuality, which I discovered over time. So I psychoanalyzed him, realized why he maybe said some of the ignorant things he did. And I used getting to know him over the years, drip feeding him information, getting myself into a position of power, and then using that to leverage what I believe in.
And that's which, like, you're looking at the outcome at the end. Yeah, if you'd have got stopped halfway and said, you can't say that, then the journey ends there, doesn't it?
So which is it? Do we use the privilege or do we not? I chose to, because I knew that my heart was good. I knew that ultimately, once I had that power, I wouldn't be pulling the ladder up behind me. Mm-hmm. I did the complete opposite. In many ways, I fucked a lot of areas of my career by being seen as being too woke.
Yes, yeah, same.
I still get it to this day. People eye roll about me behind my back, like, oh, of course he's saying this, of course. I'm like, yeah, of course I've been saying the same shit since I was 19 years old.
Same.
That's why I'm still saying it.
So it was really interesting what you said before about being working class, and, well, these doors don't get open for us very often. You know, normally it's like, I've just stopped working in a place where, the PA to someone very senior was, you know, the person that got them into the company was the CEO of another thing, and then they get them in just as a kind of fucking PA, and I'm like, and here I am doing my thing, surrounded by people who have completely different opinions to me. And what do I do there? What do you do in that situation?
It's difficult because you're like, you want to do the right thing. You want to make sure you're being, like, true to your morals and your thoughts and your beliefs. But on the same, you have to be realistic about, if you're going to have influence in the mainstream in any capacity, you do most of the time have to mix with pieces of shit.
Mm.
And that sucks.
At some point.
And it sucks. But I'd rather take the bullet as me and drip feed information, let me hear the harsh shit, and drip feed them so them, you know, maybe educate them a bit over time, then let them go out and spout it unchallenged. Mm-hmm. I just challenge it in my own way, and like you said, being working class, you don't have, I don't have the luxury to feel like I can turn away those opportunities.
No, same.
Because once I remember getting my first ones, being like, I remember getting my first pay increase at my head office job, feeling like I should go in and kiss my boss's feet, and then you realize over time, I should have been paid a lot more than that.
Mm.
So it's easier said than done to be like, oh, well, you shouldn't. I think that if you're in a position emotionally and morally to be able to Trojan horse the business, CEO,
do it,
person of power,
you're doing it for us all,
just do it, you know, just you take a few of the bullets if you're a person of privilege, so that, you know, the people who are going to be really damaged by those comments and stupid presumptions and, you know, jokes that we hear in offices, you take the bullet, because you're going to make it a little bit easier for someone else behind you. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah.
But look at America right now. Look at what's happening here. We're not in an ideal world. And I think we dreamed for about 7 years that we were heading towards one.
And we weren't. So here's my chat with Kevin Guyon at the University of Edinburgh.
Queer politics, sex, and culture. This is Outcast World.
I want to talk to you about queer data, which is your other book. And in Queer Data, you argue that data isn't neutral. Data is a tool of power. And for listeners who haven't come across that idea before, what does it mean for queer people to be made through data?
Yeah, so Queer Data was my first book. It came out in 2022 and was kind of really my on-ramp to lots of these discussions we're having right now around LGBTQ lives, experiences, categories, classifications, labels. How are people counted in a variety of different spaces and places? And data, particularly numerical data, I became fascinated with during the COVID pandemic. We're speaking a lot about statistics, about kind of graphs, figures, bar charts. I became really interested in what this meant for LGBTQ people living in the UK. And again, thinking critically about actually this idea of being counted, being categorised, being seen by something like the state, what are the benefits and what are the risks? So around this time, there were also discussions about these new questions in the census, which I touched on earlier. And again, I was kind of surprised how little criticism there was among LGBTQ communities about some of the risks and dangers that might accompany being counted by the state and telling the state information about your sexual orientation and your gender identity. So this was just years ago now, and since then, census data has been published. So I know in Scotland, where I'm based, we know from the census at least that 4% of the population identified as LGB and 0.4% identified as trans. But going to what you asked in your question about the construction of these communities, I like to take those percentages very much with a lot of scepticism. And why I say that, as those kind of headline percentages, those numbers, those things which are often presented as ahistorical, apolitical, numbers, how can they be political? Actually, numbers are always political, because lying just under the surface, there was a ton of decisions made about who was counted, who was in, who was out. The question was a voluntary question, so there was no requirement to disclose, which I do think was a good thing. The question was only asked to people age 16 and over. The question was asked at the level of a household. So for those who were in the UK at the time, one person in the household reported on everyone else in the household. Yeah. You can imagine how that could be very problematic in some households where you're asking. If your mom's kind of marking the sexual orientation of her 17 and 18-year-old kids, again, some real political kind of dimensions to this. So for me, numbers about any kind of identity group, whether it's along lines of sexuality, race, disability, gender, they always come with a politics and they come with a history. And actually, numbers can be really powerful because when presented as a statistic, as something like 4% or as a kind of numerical figure, they lose a lot of that politics. They become something we see as objective or as a matter of fact. But actually, looking just under the surface, there's lots of decisions being made to kind of create the veneer of something that's objective or numerical or a truth.
So what are the risks of being counted badly or not being counted at all? And in your view, which is actually more dangerous for LGBTQ plus communities? Is it being counted badly in a kind of way we discussed there, or just being left out of the census?
It's a challenge I'm navigating right now in my own research and writing. Increasingly, I think we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't in lots of these conversations. And why I say that is being counted badly invites a lot of risks and dangers. In some writing, I've explored the idea of Goldilocks data. And what I mean by that are these headline percentages on the size of the LGBTQ community. So as I said, for LGB people in Scotland, it's 4%. Why I was really worried about that number was it was always going to be both too big and too small for people who are opposed to LGBTQ equalities. So the right-wing media will think 4% is too big. It's a number out of control. There's too many young people identifying as queer. It's a story we see a lot in the right-wing media. At the same time, it's going to be too small because 4%, people will use that percentage to say, how can we justify this amount of funding the government provides LGBTQ charities to organizations supporting LGBTQ people if they only constitute 4% of the population? So the number is always going to be weaponized in good and bad ways. At the same time, not being counted is what we see as a tactic in many countries around the world. So whether it's in countries like Russia, Iran, where the leaders have said LGBT people do not exist in this country. They are not here. They do not exist. You cannot be Russian and queer. And how they're able to say that is because the data does not exist. The data has not been counted to show that these communities, of course, exist as they do in all parts of the world, in all cultures, all societies. So again, the decision not to count can easily be used and weaponized in ways that serve the interests of those who are opposed to LGBTQ equalities. So it's a real damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. With quite a lot of these data collection exercises, it's also a topic that's growing. So as I highlighted, the UK was among the first in the world to ask these questions in its census. But since then, other countries like Canada, Ireland, Australia next year are all adding questions to their census to count the number of LGBTQ people. And I think there are some benefits to that, some opportunities. But also, as we've seen, particularly in the UK, in the few years since the census, this data can be weaponized in ways it does harm and does damage to the communities, particularly trans communities in the UK, and how the data around the number of trans people can be used as kind of ammunition to kind of counter claims to kind of advance equalities for these groups. So, yeah, it's a real double-edged sword, quite a lot of these discussions.
So, on that kind of note, one of the dangers of collecting this kind of data is, I guess it's reflected in Germany, isn't it, where they don't take a lot of information about people's ethnicity in particular, because historically it's been a no-no, because they collected that information before and it was horrifically misused. You know, it was used to power the Holocaust, essentially, wasn't it? There is these risks. You know, it's relatively safe in the UK now to provide this information, but what about in the future? Is this data anonymized? Could it be used at some point? And, you know, this used to be a completely outlandish thought process, but at some point for us to all be rounded up and locked in some sort of concentration camp.
Yeah, I think your question touches on two extremely important points. And I think the idea of time and how kind of our engagement with the data needs to always be mindful of both our history and our future. So in a previous life, my kind of research was in history. I was a historian for a brief period of time. And I'm really interested in the history of data about LGBTQ people in the UK. And for a kind of piece of writing a few years ago for LGBT History Month, I wrote a blog post looking at what historical data exists on gay men in the UK. I went into archives, I had a look, and unsurprisingly, pretty much all of the existing data on gay men in the UK was extremely one-sided. It was negative. It was data about criminal records. It was data on deviance, on psychological maladjustment, really kind of negative pictures of these communities. So it was really then surprising to bring us up to the census, where this kind of negative one-sided history was very quickly overlooked. We kind of forgot that historically, until very recently, pretty much all data about these communities has been used by the state, by organisations to cause harm, to cause damage, to kind of ruin people's lives in a variety of ways. And how many of those institutions now asking us to share information about our sexuality, about our gender, are the same institutions that were doing this 10, 20, 30 years ago. At the same time, it's really important to look towards the future, to look and think about how this data might be weaponized and used in ways that we maybe can't even foresee right now. So I do think, generally, in 2025, it is fairly safe to share data about your sexuality, about your gender identity in something like a national census. But we've also seen how quickly politics can move. And we have no idea the political situation in the UK in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time. And as you've highlighted with your question, how these data sets, how this data set of, for example, every trans person living in the UK can easily be used in extremely dangerous and devastating ways. So when people ask me, should I share information with the state, the police, my healthcare provider on my identity characteristics, I always just ask them to think not just about this present moment, but think about the future. Think about how it might be used in good and bad ways down the line. And if you're willing to live with that risk, go ahead, share information. If you're in doubt, if you don't want to share the information, don't feel obliged to. Don't feel as if you have to disclose information about who you are. So I'm a big fan of the prefer not to say box in these types of diversity monitoring forums, surveys, in terms of giving people the space to actively choose not to disclose. You're actively saying no thanks. And I think that can be a real, I think I'm hoping to kind of reframe those discussions as well. It's not people being lazy or indifferent or unbothered. Actually taking prefer not to say can be a real act of agency. It can be a real kind of power saying, I don't want to participate in that question.
We live inside algorithmic platforms that make decisions about us before we even open our mouths. How do queer people get harmed in these automated systems, in your opinion?
Yeah, so we've spoken a lot in our conversation about people actively disclosing information about who they are. So whether it's me in my job at the university, kind of outing myself, saying I'm gay, I'm here, I'm kind of happy to work with students to teach on LGBTQ topics. We've spoken about things like the census, where people are actively disclosing information about who they are or those in the household. But these are only one type of how, one way that we share information about who we are. Actually, in this very kind of this digital world, we're not often asked to self-disclose or share information about who we are, but these tech platforms, websites, apps can often discern and make a very educated guess about our age, our gender, or sexuality just by what we're clicking, looking at, buying, where we're located. So this whole kind of tech ecosystem can often paint maybe an even more accurate picture of our identity characteristics without asking us to share information about who we are or what we do. Now, some of the benefits, I guess, from that are these kind of recommender systems. So we know things like Spotify, Netflix will share with us kind of, I don't know, gay-themed Christmas films, queer classics, without asking us to actually disclose information about our sexuality or our gender. But at the same time, there are risks and dangers about being put into boxes and categories that categorise us in certain ways, whether it's along the lines of our identity, without actively asking us who we are or what we want to see. So I think this kind of, this behavioural form of kind of coding, of categorising communities, also has some real dystopian dimensions to it. We can see how in some countries this data could be used in ways to identify queer activists, queer agitators, whether it's through where they're locating, through kind of geolocating, where they're checking in, what they're kind of uploading to social media, which could then be used to kind of draw lists of things like that. So again, you can see how this kind of surveillance society can take really dark turns, and how we're not a million miles away. The technology exists already. It's just more about how it's being implemented in ways to avoid these types of things from happening.
You talk about queer data futures. So what does a data system built for queer people rather than about queer people look like, if there was one?
Yeah, so I, in both the first book and the second book, kind of look through some of the common solutions to the problems facing queer people in technology and in apps and platforms. And often the solution has been, if something isn't working, the tech company will say, well, simply just add more options. So we see this particularly on things like dating apps, on fitness apps, how in the mid-2010s, there were concerns raised that these apps are not inclusive enough, they're not diverse enough, they're not recognising the full menu of sexualities, of genders, of desires. So many of these companies, particularly dating apps, simply added more options. The drop-down list increased from maybe 5 to 15. We had more sexualities, more genders, more desires. There are some positives to that, definitely a more kind of broader net. But at the same time, nothing really changed about the underlying system or structure that these apps and technologies were running on. It was the same types of technologies, just with more options added. And in some cases, we saw that actually at the back end, even though the drop-down menu might have 15 sexualities, at the back end of the technology, they were then aggregated just into two buckets, kind of gay or straight. And we saw this happening in technologies like Facebook. So again, this veneer of being inclusive, veneer of being diverse, actually in reality, it was the same type of sorting processes happening at the back end. So for me, a kind of a queer data future really reinvents this entire way of thinking about categorization of technology, about how we're counted, who's counting, and also creating spaces for being subversive, being different, being difficult, being somebody who maybe frustrates these categories, these assumptions. So in the new book, I describe this idea of box breakers. And the concept box breakers for me means two things. So if you're a box breaker, you are somebody who firstly says no to the options available. So you look down that drop-down list of sexualities and you go, none of them are for me. I'm going to take prefer not to say, I'm going to skip that question. At the same time, a box breaker also does something excitingly destructive. So when they're brought into these tech systems, because they are so incongruous, because they don't fit, they actually expose the design of the system as a charade. They highlight how it's all made up. These rules, these categories, these boxes, these buckets, they're actually not a representation of the real world out there. They're actually the product of a designer. Somebody designed whether sexuality was fluid or fixed, whether the gender options were 4, 5, 6. So again, box breakers, I think, is a real way to kind of bring about this kind of queer data future. We're actually creating spaces for people who don't fit the prescribed rules, who push back against the options, who kind of subvert the assumptions of what the system's trying to get us to do is one kind of window or one way we can kind of move into this more queer approach to tech more broadly.
Data is a huge thing. It drives everything in the world at the moment. And if you could ban one current data practice tomorrow because of its harm to LGBTQ plus people, would you, and what would it be?
Yeah. Oh, fantastic question. I'm not going to ban a practice, but I'm going to ban some words which have really been getting on my nerves the past few months. And the first word is this discussion about accuracy, data accuracy. Now, accuracy is a really interesting word. The word accuracy is something that's presented to us as being always good. Of course we want accurate data. Of course we want systems that are accurate. But it's being used and weaponized in ways, lots of conversations right now, to do quite the opposite. So actually, accuracy, this idea of having a neat and tidy data set where everything is lined up in neat rows, neat boxes, doesn't work for many queer people. Some people who maybe identities are fluid, they're changing, they maybe don't know how they identify, they don't fit these neat, accurate systems. So what happens to them? They ultimately ended up discarded, they're pushed out of these data sets, data systems, technologies, they are presented as inaccurate data points. And we see this in quite a lot of conversations right now, particularly around trans data and how trans people are counted and categorized in data systems. So one thing I would ban is the easy or quick use of the word data accuracy. Actually, I want us to think, who is this data? It's never accurate. And again, we're demanding something of data it can't do. Numbers, quantitative data, ones and zeros, it can't easily reflect the messiness, the nuance, the complexity of queer lives. And nor should it. I think that's perfectly fine for us to go, actually, we can't translate this amazingly kind of wonderfully diverse, fluid world into something that sits in neat rows and boxes. So I'd kind of push back and ban people's misuse of the word accuracy in discussions about tech and data. And again, just thinking kind of accurate for whom? Is it accurate for the person designing the data set, the data system, or is it actually accurate for the person being counted? Does it reflect their life and their experience? So, yeah. Maybe the word accuracy has been my thing I'd quite happily discard from the
It's really interesting because, I mean, it's not accurate, is it? It just looks neat on a spreadsheet kind of thing, as opposed to something that's a bit tricky to compute. Kevin, that was a really fascinating chat. Thank you so much for that. Really, really enjoyed it. The two books are Queer Data, which came out in 2022 and you can get now, and the latest book is The Rainbow Trap, which is available, should we just say, in all good bookstores, particularly queer independent bookstores? Would that be the right answer?
All good bookstores, yeah. Queer indie bookstores, I'll find them out. They'll definitely be stalking it.
Kevin, at the University of Edinburgh, thank you so much for filling us in on all this. It's been really fascinating.
Thanks for the conversation.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.